Okay, we were talking about the papacy, and one of the things that goes on throughout this period is a battle, really, between the Pope and the secular powers that be, whatever they might be. Many times it's the emperor. Other times it's kings and the like. And I think I mentioned, I'm not sure how far we've gotten, but we hit a period of time in the late 700s where you have the Pope, in this case Stephen, going up into France and appointed because of wanting protection from some of these Germanic tribes that were a threat, appointing Pepin as the king. And when Pepin died, his two sons, Charlemagne and Carloman, took over. When Carloman died, and you may be familiar with the term, with the name Charlemagne. Charlemagne, I guess, is known for a number of things, but one of the things he did is basically unite what we call Western Europe today into his empire. And he won the blessing of the Pope, and turns out had another Lombard invasion of Italy, so he goes down, rescues Italy, and the Pope, as because of that, placed a crown upon his head and called him Augustus. You may remember Augustus is the term for their emperor. And Charlemagne, as a result of that, increased the Pope's territory from what he had, so the papal states increased somewhat. I think the data I saw said it was about 30% of Italy at its peak. So this is the size of the empire, the religious empire, not religious, the property empire of the Pope at this point in time. And really what would happen, the emperors would try to engage with the popes throughout this period of time, because just like when we went back to Constantine and his desire to treat the Christians right, he did it for his empire. He wanted to maintain unity in his empire. And so the various kings and emperors would tie up with the popes to try to strengthen their position. Well, in doing so, that had the opposite effect, that you'd end up that the popes would gain strength as well. But Charlemagne himself, having been named pope, I mean named emperor, king, by the Pope, ended up injecting himself after his coronation into the church in various ways. He did not recognize, even though he'd been crowned by the Pope, he didn't recognize the Pope as being his superior, and he went the other way. He ended up directing missions, promoting ecclesiastical kinds of legislation, strengthening the church government, supervised election of bishops, established schools, monasteries, set educational standards, got involved in missions, sending out missionaries. So Charlemagne was very active in the Pope's business. And, of course, the Pope was not particularly crazy about that. The one thing the Pope, or one thing Charlemagne and the Pope disagree on, we talked about the worship of images. Charlemagne was strongly against that. And in fact, even though worshiping of images went on in Italy, north of the Alps, there wasn't any worshiping of images until sometime around 1100 period A.D. The Pope also, I mean, the Charlemagne also organized something for the first time called metropolitans. And these were broader districts, and they appointed archbishops. So you now have archbishops and bishops below the archbishops. He again, trying to reinforce his empire, he provided tax relief for the churches and the monasteries, gave grants for monasteries, so the monasteries grew, ended up allowing the church matters to be settled in ecclesiastical courts as opposed to secular courts, and things of that nature. So he was very active in the Pope's backyard, in some ways being supportive of him, and in other ways getting Pope, setting the Pope sort of aside in terms of what the Pope's role was. After Charlemagne died, then you had three grandsons that took over for him, and then ultimately in 962, Otto the Great reunified the empire from these three, and he was crowned Emperor of the Romans. And this was you hear the term the Holy Roman Empire. This is the Holy Roman Empire of Germany under Otto the Great. So, 960, 1000 AD, you had your secular empire on one hand, and you had a spiritual, quote unquote, empire under the Pope on the other hand. And supposedly they existed as sort of equals. But in fact, they were in sort of mortal combat, if you like, between the two of them. Some held that the Pope had authority over the secular rulers, and therefore were secular authority. Some held that they were equal. God appointed both of them for different purposes. And some held the emperor, the Pope served at the whim of the emperor. The emperor was appointed by God, and the Pope was subservient to that. And this will go on for a good while. This is something that goes on. These kinds of conflicts will go on throughout the Middle Ages, up until probably the 1400s sometime. Along the lines of this, there's another event another situation that existed, and that is you had feudalism that came in to be the social system in the 1100s, 1200s, 1000 probably, 1000 to 1300. And feudalism, under feudalism, you had nobles who were appointed by the king and owned land, and then they had vassals under them that basically took care of the land, rented the land, or in some way were subservient to the nobles. And in general, they took care of the land, but they also paid back to the nobles for protection from enemies. And then the kings themselves, you had the nobles were vassals of the king. Well, the king himself viewed himself as a vassal of God. And so he had his power coming from God. Well, the Pope viewed himself as God's vassal. So we have another aspect of this conflict going on. And so Otto, like his predecessors, to strengthen his position, took action toward the church organization, donated land to the church, great portions of land, great estates of land, and he ended up providing certain bishops with the land. So the bishops became, quote, nobles in a sense. They were his vassal. As a result of that, what really happened is the secular power over the church was strengthened, because now you have another case of where these religious leaders are getting their power and their property and all that kind of stuff from the state. And since they were, the church itself was dependent upon the emperor for all this increase in temporal authority, then he took that to the next stage. You may have heard of investiture. Investiture is where the emperor appointed a person, a official to a church position, and that began to happen under Otto the Great. He would appoint people in the church to their particular positions, and this is called so-called investiture. And he would give them a symbol of that. And it was a ring and a staff. And they not only got out of that temporal jurisdiction, he gave them some responsibility over affairs of state. They got to serve. They had the right to serve in the church. And so he began to take on a much greater role, if you like, of managing the church government under his kingship or emperorship, whatever you want to call him. And so in by doing this investiture, of course, he royally upset the popes of the time. But in fact, he ended up, or the emperors during this state ended up, period of time rather, ended up being the key actors and providing for the church personnel and positions. And in addition to that, since he had pulled together these kinds of things during this period of time at least, it ended up the emperor basically had authority over the church, even though the pope was in place. And in fact, the emperor began appointing the popes. So you now have, rather than the pope being elected from within the system, which had historically been the case, you've got the secular government appointing the pope. There was a fellow named Henry III, just to give you some facts.
What period of time is this?
We're in the 1100-1200 general period of time.
Thank you.
1046, Henry III disposed of three rival popes, and he appointed a German bishop head of the church, just to give you an indication of what went on. So you had these three guys who were claiming to be pope, and he took care of that. In following up on that, Henry, by the way, was a German king. In following up on that, he appointed the next three successive popes as well. And so he could have the power to throw them out and the power to put them in place. And during this period of time, this 1100, early 1200 period, that generally speaking, the church, the people, recognized the power of the pope, of the emperor, to put the pope in place and not come from within the body of so-called believers. Of course, even though they were put there, as soon as they got there, they didn't acknowledge, they were not willing to acknowledge that they were subservient to the emperor. So you still got the battle going on throughout this period of time. There are two documents, fraudulent documents, I referenced in your lesson, that would play into this whole battle of who had power, who was in control. One of them is this false decretals of Isidore. Isidore was a Spanish archbishop who was well known for his writing and his mental accomplishments, as well as moral accomplishments for that matter. And his authority, his name basically, was used to put together a forgery. And the forgery was written to add prestige to the Roman bishop. As the forger put his document together, he put it together on the basis of decrees that came from unknown councils, therefore they were unknown creeds, and quoted letters that were claimed to have been written by Clement of Rome. Clement of Rome lived I think he was like, I want to say like 200 to 300 A.D. And so these were used, the first guy that seems to be the first guy anyway among those who claimed to be pope that used this was Nicholas I, and he used it to increase his spiritual authority on the basis of these false documents. And as far as the authority of the the spiritual authority of the papacy in the whole world. At the same time, in doing that, or I'd rather not at the same time, but as a part of doing that, he exercised his power as being the chief bishop, or i.e. the pope, over everybody else, and got rid of doing things like excommunicating patriarchs and getting rid of archbishops and things of that nature, sort of at will. And he really ended up being one of the stronger popes in that sense that had ever been in the position up to that point in time. Others would come in that would be even stronger as time went on. There was another document called the Donation of Constantine, written in the 8th century. And you'll love this one. Do I have this in your notes about what was contained in this? I don't think I do. Do you? Do I? I mean, your lesson? What the document was?
No.
Okay. This one says Constantine was afflicted by leprosy. And while he had his leprosy, Peter and Paul appeared to him in a vision, telling him to have Pope Sylvester, of course it wasn't really a pope at this time, but a bishop of Rome, Pope Sylvester come and baptize him 3 times for the cleansing of his leprosy and removal of his sin. According to the document, Constantine did this and was healed of his leprosy. And so he exalted Sylvester. It states that since he is seen to have been set up as the vicar of God's Son on earth, inasmuch as our imperial power is earthly, we have decreed that it shall venerate and honor his most holy Roman Church, and that the sacred seed of the blessed Peter shall be gloriously exalted above our empire and earthly throne. So this document, though it was false, elevated the Bishop of Rome to be over, to be God's vassal, in other words, over all secular authority as well as spiritual authority. And it played an important role. I mean, subsequent popes would use this to establish their authority linked back to early in the empire, and yet it was a false document. And that false aspect was unquestioned, or the truthfulness of this was unquestioned until about the 15th century, and then it came to light that it was false. And in fact, the Roman Catholic Church agrees it's false. I actually agree both of these are false. And in spite of that, the fact that it existed as long as it did, and people used it as much as they did, it strengthened the papacy throughout this period. And once they said it was false, it was too late. The damage basically had been done. And so they used this very much to provide the kind of power that the papacy would come to have. Okay, so that's some of the, in this period of time, that's some of the dealings that are going on that are giving, I guess you can say, are either strengthening or detracting from the power and the extent of the power of the church and the papacy vis-a-vis the secular authorities that existed at the time. Somebody have something to say?
On this document, so Constantine had leprosy and was cured. Well, did they ever find out, did he really have leprosy, or was he really cured? What was that?
No.
He never had leprosy?
No, of course not. Well, if he had it, he wouldn't have cured, but you know, he never had it.
Yeah.
No miracle. It's just totally false, made up.
Now, this is more about positioning and power in the secular world, and not so much about the spiritual well-being of anyone.
Well, these are, these activities are both. This particular one has more to do with who has power, who's God's vassal, and therefore everybody else is my vassal. You know, if I'm God's vassal, says the Pope, and the secular authorities, the temporal authorities, are in subjection to me. So that was that kind of power. Yes.
So it seems like that then the doctrine at this point in time, very little change in it. It's been set, and the Pope rules.
Well, remember we talked about when I introduced this lesson, I'll rattle them off to you again. Starting in 593 all the way up to 1439, purgatory, prayer to Mary, saints. I mean, a bunch of doctrines are being developed that we know today, that exist today, during this period of time. The evolution of the Catholic Church, or let me restate that, what the Catholic Church ended up being, in many ways, was set in stone during the medieval period. Mm-hmm. We're going to talk in a minute, hope to, about, well, we already talked about the monks. Well, you know, everybody in this room has heard of Franciscan, Dominican, Jesuit monks, or orders, if you like. Those were all set in this time period, came into being. And that's the nature of, I mean, there's a lot of turmoil because of the geopolitical issues. I know I've given you a lot of stuff, but that's what was going on, and that's the way, you know, it's the old business. These guys were being sharpened against one another, and eventually somebody's going to win. And so you see that happening during this period. In addition to that, we've already talked about all the councils that went on, particularly early on. Come on in. We'll have to do a little. Where are we going? You want that in?
We're in lesson 10.
Somebody else will have to take on what page?
66.
Okay. Is that the one on the floor?
Yeah, that was the one on the floor.
Thank you. Okay. Did I gang that close out on that? Okay. So we talked a little bit about this, but really the reason I want to bring this back in is we see the real strengthening of monasticism over this period of time. It grows. We've talked about the idea. You go back in the idea of having a ascetic lifestyle goes all the way back to the Jews, and probably before that, but certainly the Jews and the Essenes. We've heard of the Essenes, Dead Sea Scroll people. They were back in the 200 BC, and as far as their heavy activity, and lasted about 300 years as far as being a significant factor. You've got the Cynics and on the Greek side. They were back in the 400-500 BC. And they all based their approach to this basic Gnostic philosophy that matter's evil, spirit's good. And so they tried to escape matter, what it boiled down to. And as a result of that, there were a number of people and groups that got formed in the course of time. One of the things, I think I mentioned this in one of our earlier studies, one of the things that specific thing about it, apart from escaping the world, our evil matter, one of the things that was a belief had to do with celibacy, had to do with, you know, it wasn't celibacy that was being called for early on. It was that being celibate, not having a wife, was the way you obtained the highest spirituality. So it wasn't a have to not, it's just, you know, kind of a step on the ladder, you know, in a manner of speaking. And it's interesting that there was conflict, of course, between the church, who would come to view itself as having the world as that which they ruled, and these ascetics looking at the world as totally evil. And so there would be conflict there. And there was a way they worked around that. There were basically two kinds of monasticism that got developed. One was in the East. It was funny, these were weather related. One was in the East because the weather in the East was milder. And so people ended up being hermits. And they would go off and live in a cave and live away from people. And that tended to be the way they existed. And some of them did. There was one in particular that did, Anthony, back in the 300s, ended up setting up a monastery out in the middle of the Nile River on an island, and brought together others who had been living the hermit life and started this monastery. There was another one that formed a, I said Anthony, take that back, it's a different name. Pacomius is the one that did that. There were a number of these ascetics that were reasonable in their approach to life, but a bunch of them were just out and out extreme. They would expose themselves to all kinds of hardship to show they were pure. They refused to wear the right kind of clothing. They got coarse, uncomfortable clothing. They tried to make their life miserable. Some would not eat anything except grass. try to be Nebuchadnezzar, I guess. Not eat anything but grass, and they'd graze like a herd of cattle. You had some that were extreme enough that they ended up living on pillars. There was a fellow by the name of Simeon, if you can believe this, lived on top of a 60-foot tall column for 36 years. That's the way he escaped the world. So, you know, they were extreme in terms of this asceticism, all driven by their desire to get away from people and to be, quote, pure that way, unquote. Then you had the other side of the empire, in the Western Empire, and there the weather was colder. And so they formed in a different way. And these are the ones that we recognize now that have kind of survived through time. Benedict was one of them. Benedict was the one that got started organizing the Western monasticism. He gathered together groups of 12 under a father, and you know that was Christ and the 12 apostles. He established monasteries. One of his monasteries, the first, in fact, was I think it was the first, was Monte Cassino. Anybody know what Monte Cassino is? Anybody ever heard of Monte Cassino? Boy, you all need to study world history, I can tell. Monte Cassino is a big monastery in Italy, and it was the site of a famous World War II battle as the Allies went up through Italy. There were over 50,000 Allies that were injured and 20,000 Germans that were killed or injured. I mean, it was a major battle to clear up and go up through Italy. Anyway, that's a side note. His sister, Benedict's sister, also found a convent in the general area. By the time he started out doing this, 529 was this Monte Cassino monastery. And then in, 20 years later, roughly 20 years later, estimated there were 100 monasteries along this same form as Monte Cassino. So a pretty active period of time for creating these monasteries where monks were located and studied and and lived a life of I guess they were all celibate, and a life of poverty. And I mentioned to you this conflict. The way they kept this conflict from having the thing blow apart was through the sacrament. The church had control over these people because of the teachings in the past and the need to partake of the sacraments. And so they didn't just totally go off the into the wild. They still maintain a link back to the church and the organization of the Catholic Church. Then there was another kind of order that developed, the medicant, which fancy word for beggar orders. These are the Franciscan and Dominican orders that we still know about today. These are orders that are the medicant monks weren't located at a monastery to do their thing. They went out among the people and lived off of the things they could collect from the people. These are your so-called friars. If you're familiar with Robin Hood, it's Friar Tuck. He was a mendicant. And another one that was known was the Jesuits, another order. Jesuits are important for a variety of reasons in terms of the development of the history of the Catholic Church, and really in terms of the spreading of the theology of the gospel, of the Catholic Church. These were the had several functions over time. They were very educated, but they weren't located. They went out and performed evangelistic work all over the world. You'll hear about Jesuit schools here, there, and yonder. They went to the Far East, they went to Japan, they came to the Americas early on. They were active in education, they were active in missionary work. They were also what you could view as the shock troops of the Counter-Reformation era. And they were the ones that would search out, for the Catholic Church, would search out these heretical people and get them to confess their heresy. And so they were very active in the leading up to, and even during the Reformation. The founder of the Jesuits is Loyola, Ignatius Loyola, or Loyola University. That's the Jesuit University. He was actually a soldier and was injured, and badly injured, and ended up being a cripple. And as he started the order in comes out in the 1540s, so you see how close it is to the Reformation. He organized his military think cap on. And he was considered the general, and he organized the recruits under this general concept. And as part of his order, you had to vow a special allegiance both to the Pope and to the general. And so he had some very, dedicated, fanatical almost, people, adherence to this particular order. And the rules that he had in place for thinking required absolute blind obedience to the Pope, in addition to calling for purity, poverty, and chastity. As I say, the main functions of this organization were foreign missions and education and fighting heresy. They, in terms of the fighting heresy, they took the view of they could justify any means provided it resulted in the right ends. So in their case, ends justify the means. And they were what was called soulless by people, their enemies. They would end up in a course of trying to get somebody to admit they were a heretic, first of all, they start from the position they were guilty. And they could torture them. They could do anything they cared to get them to admit that they were guilty. And so they were effective in one sense in terms of carrying out the church's will this time. But they also made themselves enemies of the governments over time. And they would ultimately be banned for a period of time.
Monasticism, that seems like it was more of a grassroots kind of...
Yeah, it wasn't...
Individual piety coming together and then it somehow gathered power enough to where the church had to take note of them.
That's correct.
Grassroots movement. And these were people, these were the most devout people in the Catholic Church at the time. I say the most. I mean, what degree of devoutness they had drove them out of the church, drove them out into the countryside.
You mentioned in your notes about the universities. Probably have heard about the Loyola universities. They're all around. One in Los Angeles, one in Chicago, one in Baltimore, one in New Orleans. So, they're there. And the other thing interesting about these Jesuits, the word Jesuit actually means a member of Jesus. Where the name comes from. So, very strong.
It's kind of, their behavior did not reflect it. You had two other things I think you've heard of from, if you remember any history. They also played in at this point in time, and while these guys were in place, one was the Inquisition, the Inquisitions, and the other is the so-called Index. The Inquisitions, the ones that are notorious are the ones that went on in Spain, the Spanish Inquisition, and they ended up, according to the data I had, something like 10,000 people were executed in those under one leadership of it, another 2,000 under another leadership of it. So, you know, they were rooting out heresy in these Inquisitions, their view of heresy in these Inquisitions. And then there was another one that was down in Rome, in the Roman Empire, Western Empire, and that was actually, they all were. They were promulgated by the Pope, the office of the Pope, and that one was too, down in Rome. And so, you know, any place that there was a view of heresy, somebody practicing heresy, they would root it out. And of course, the Reformation, it was all heresy to the Catholic Church, by and large, are the precursors to the Reformation, whichever one it was. And the result of being the beneficiary of an Inquisition, if you lived, you could die. You definitely would. You most likely would be tortured. You'd lose your property. You were, as I said, you were guilty. You were soon guilty. So unless you could somehow prove your innocence, and they really weren't interested in your innocence, then you were going to lose out. The punishments themselves would take place under the local secular authority. And so the inquisitors from the church would root these people out and say, okay, they're guilty, take care of them. And that didn't, you know, for some I'm sure that set well, for some that didn't set well, and ultimately that's what would, because of the way the Jesuits acted, they eventually, some of the governors banned them. And then they would come back in a different form. And not be this chasing heresy all the time.
Hey, Wally?
Yeah.
You have in your notes under the monasticism in the church, part two, you're talking about how the sacraments was the tie between the monks and the institutional church.
Yeah.
When you say purgatory became the equalizer between these two, this double standard, what do you mean by that?
Well, if you... You're in the church, or you're a monk, right? And if you choose to suffer as a monk, You choose to suffer as a monk. It's the suffer here route. If you're out of phase, if you choose to do wrong, you're also a suffer in the sense of suffer later in purgatory. And so, purgatory was invented because of the sacraments issue and penance, actually. If you didn't do sufficient penance, you're going to purgatory. Well, there would be some of that same view with the monks. If they didn't do their thing, then they would be subject to purgatory. They didn't connect back to the church. So they kept connected back to the church. They didn't get, they didn't go off the reservation, so to speak. Even though the church was crooked, worldly. There was really no reason for them to associate with it. Okay. Last thing was index. Index is a book, is a listing of books you're not allowed to read. That's what the index was. So you had the Inquisition was one thing, and the index. Well, in the Reformation, you're starting to have printing in place, and so there are books. This is the period of the Renaissance. There's a entirely different view of the importance of education and thinking, so there were books that would be promoting theology. Thoughts were different than the orthodoxy, and as a result of that, you ended up having this index that was managed to be the books you weren't to read.
Was the Bible on that list?
Sorry?
Was the Bible on that list?
I don't know right now. I'll try to look and see. Can't remember.
He's talking about not the one that the Catholic Bible ordained.
Well, the Vatican Vulgate, thank you.
Yeah.
That was the official approved version of the Bible for the Catholic. So if anybody produced another Bible, like would happen, is you get the Reformation printing press coming into being, and the Reformation coming into being, and certainly when King James Bible comes into being, those would have, if there was an index, then they would have fallen under the index, because they were not the Latin version. Okay, Catholic Church and the Bible. I know this may come as a minor shock to you, but you should know that the Bible you have before you is a Catholic book. And by the way, the things I have here in this rest of this lesson, these are doctrines that are current, but developed over a period of time. And I've quoted a number of references, Catholics question box and things of that nature. So these are writings that come from somewhere within the Catholicism. It could be an approved writing, or it could be somebody that is talking about his religion and reporting what it is. So they maintain that you see in 1A under this section, the Bible is truly a Catholic book. They are members of the Catholic Church, and under God's inspiration wrote the New Testament in its entirety. I'm asking you a question. There's a false premise leading to a false conclusion in the statement, that statement above it, statement A. What's the false premise? Oh, you're saved by the bell. Somebody take a shot at the false. What's the false premise?
The Bible was written way before the Catholic Church.
The false premise is the apostles and prophets were members of the Catholic Church. Well, that's not true. And we'll talk about that briefly when we get back together. So they're wrong as they get out of the gate. Okay, thank you very much. We'll pick up that, and we'll be in chat. We'll be in lesson 11, relatively short lesson. We'll try to get through lesson 11, he said. Thank you.